chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. I am thrilled to have Sean Swarner on the show today. Sean is an author, adventurer, multiple world record holder, and master of mindset. Well, Sean Swarner, welcome to the Something Extra podcast. I am so excited about our conversation today. I cannot wait to have our listeners learn from you. You are such an inspiring human being.
I appreciate that. I'm excited because maybe we can give your listeners a little something extra.
Amen to that. That's awesome. Well, and I know you're so busy. So thank you for making the time. You are preparing for a really big event that we're going to talk about. You just let me know that, hey, I'm filming a commercial in 45 minutes. So it's like, wow, you've got a lot on your plate. So I'm very honored that you're making the time. But you had reached out to me on LinkedIn, Sean, back in July, and you and I connected, we had a conversation, and here we are. But this is just for our listeners. So Sean Swarner is celebrated as one of the top 8 most inspirational people in history. He holds multiple world records, has been the subject of an Emmy-nominated Amazon film. It's called True North. Our family has sat down and watched that film. Highly recommend it. Has appeared on major networks such as ESPN, CBS, NBC, ABC, Fox, CNN, along with other numerous domestic and international platforms. He's the only person in history to have climbed Mount Everest, scaled the highest mountain on each continent, skied to both the North and South Poles, and completed the Hawaii Ironman Triathlon after doing something. And so Sean, I've told our listeners a little bit about you, but I haven't told them the other part. So I want you to tell them that, you know, what is the other part of this story?
Well, the other part is I accomplished all that after surviving 2 terminal cancers, a prognosis of 3 months to live, 14 days to live from the second cancer. I was in a medically induced coma for a year of my life, and I only have one lung. But going back to what you mentioned on the top 8 most inspiration, every time I hear that, I think my mom must have been on that voting panel.
That's funny. That's funny. That's okay, though. That's all right. And she probably, you know, it's one of those things where you can vote multiple times, right, Sean? No, you're such an inspiring human being. That's why I was so excited to have you on. So, you know, let's talk about that. You know, let's go back to your young childhood. And, you know, you were very young, you know, when this happened. Tell us the stories.
Well, it's interesting how if you look back on your life, there are probably, for everyone, there are probably a handful of things that happened that literally changed the trajectory of your path. And for me, one of them was being diagnosed at 13, on the cusp of my teen years, with advanced stage 4 Hodgkin's lymphoma. And when most people are going to school, being nervous about where they're going to sit at lunch, you know, I was nervous and freaking out about if I was going to wake up the next day. And I wasn't worried about being popular. I wasn't worried about those seemingly mundane things. You know, I was worried about and focused on what really, truly mattered in value. I valued. So going through the first cancer, I gained 60, 70 pounds, lost all the hair in my body, lost my friends, lost everything. And eventually walked out, a hairless, happy, bloated young man because of the miracle of modern medicine, family support, prayer, and just an inner will to get up out of the hospital. And then I was in remission for a year, just over a year, and going in for a checkup for the first cancer. They actually found a second cancer, which was completely unrelated to the first one. And it wasn't a side effect from the treatments. It was totally unrelated. And no one's ever had Hodgkin's and Askin's sarcoma before. So the doctors had no idea what was going to happen. And this time around, I was diagnosed with a type of cancer that affects 3 out of 1 million people with a prognosis of 6%. So my chances of survival were pretty much zero. You know, they gave me 14 days to live. I was read my last rites. I was placed in a medically induced coma. Every time I went into the hospital, I went in Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and then I'd be released so my body could recover. And then I would go back in Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. That would be one cycle. And every time I was in the hospital, because the treatments were so harsh, the doctors knocked me out. And I don't remember being 16 years old. Now, granted, a lot of people probably wish they could forget being 16 because it's so painful, but yeah, I just didn't have that choice. And I lost the function of my right lung because of the radiation therapy. But looking back at it, it was something where at the time, you know, I asked myself, why me, why me? But asking those questions didn't change the fact that I had cancer. So what was I going to do about it? How was I going to deal with the situation? Having that defeatist attitude, having that scared persona about me, being afraid of everything. And now people are like, oh, well, aren't you afraid? Because I'll be talking about, I just got COVID. Like, aren't you afraid of dying of COVID? Every little cough, every little sneeze, you know, oh my God, it's cancer. I don't let that stuff get to me. And I've learned through the years that what I've gone through, those difficult times, can potentially, depending on your perspective, can potentially build you stronger later in life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, what you do today, and we're going to talk about that. I don't want to get ahead of myself, but what you do today is help people with this unstoppable grit and determination and resilience. And you say, if I can do it, you can do it. And you help people overcome their own Everest. You were so kind, Sean, after we spoke. Here comes a book in the mail, your book in the mail that you sent to me, and it's called Being Unstoppable, Conquering Your Everest. I will tell you, I had a really hard time putting this book down. I really did. I mean, I just kept reading and reading. I would highly recommend our listeners to get the book. But it broke my heart because you talked about going through this and what you went through. It broke my heart when I heard you talk about how the kids would call you Cancer Boy. And, you know, you did. You lost so much of your, how your life, you know, you lost so much of your life. You said that you already mentioned it, but I said, you know, you said your friends were worried about being cool or what kind of shoes they were going to wear. And you are worried about whether or not I'm going to survive. It completely changes your perspective. So today, you know, you are really inspiring hope for other cancer patients because you said so many times you felt hopeless. There's this hope, but hopelessness feeling that you had. But, you know, the last few days, I think that the last time you were diagnosed, you said you had 14 days that you were given to live. I mean, Sean, there is no doubt you are a miracle. And I happen to believe that we are all put here for a purpose. I want to read one thing from your book that I just love. You said, you know, I look back at my life, I realize every step I had taken was a choice. Every decision I had made, every turn I had taken had brought me to where I was right now, on my way to the top of the world. And so even those hard things, you have used them now to help other people, Sean. So, you know, what did you do? Because I know that you were a big mindset. You figured out, even at that young age, about mindset and visualization. And I think, if I recall right, you wanted to win a swim meet. You wanted to place first. What was the thing that kept you hopeful during this time, Sean? And I am sure there were days where you were not that, but don't discount too. You had an incredibly supportive family, right? You had an incredibly supportive family.
Absolutely. I have never made it to the top of any significant peak by myself. You know, Everest, the highest mountain on every continent, North Pole, South Pole. I've been up Kilimanjaro now 25 times. I lead a group up every year as a fundraiser for a cancer charity. And we also use it as a transformative, immersive coaching experience. So we have double the success rate on the mountain. The average of the mountain is 48%. I'm at 99%. And I think it's because I have a number of things, but it's because I have the right people in the right places. The doctors were there, the family was there, the nurses were there. And, you know, if you have ever had anyone who cared about you, then you have something to fight for, someone to fight for. And it's not all about what you can do for yourself, but also how much you give back. You know, we're not all going to climb Mount Everest, but we all have an Everest to climb. Hence the title of the book, Being Unstoppable, Conquering Your Everest. You know, I can't tell you how to, and no one in their right mind can look at you and say, Lisa, this is how you're going to be successful. You have to figure that out on your own. External inspiration never lasts. You have to find that empowerment within. So looking at everything that I've gone through, I have used the trauma to push myself to triumph based on my perspective. You know, I could have come out, and anyone can come out on the other side of any traumatic experience. It doesn't have to be cancer. It could be a divorce. It could be a car accident. It could be anything. Mm-hmm. It's your choice to see how you want to use those things, or it's your choice to react in any situation you're in. And I think, you know, looking at the book, I've had a lot of people tell me, you know, I read the entire thing last night. I was like, people say that quite often, but it's because I want it to be real, authentic, genuine. I don't want it to be just some fluff piece where people are like, oh my God, that's so cute. You know, no, I want this to be, oh my God, that's real. Because that's what life is, you know, and why hold back? Why pull the punches when you're struggling through life? And for me, there are months, day after day after day after day, where I was terrified to close my eyes at night because I didn't know if I was going to wake up the next day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Completely changes your perspective. Well, I'm so proud of what you're doing. Well, you know, after I'm gonna take us one step back. In 93, 5 years after you were diagnosed with cancer the first time, you went on to college at Westminster College in Pennsylvania, and you went to graduate school. I think you were pursuing a degree in psychology. And I think your thought was, Sean, I'll go and be a psychologist for cancer patients. But you had a pivotal moment. You had a pivotal moment. I don't know if you want to talk about that story at all. But you came up with this big BHAG, what I call the BHAG, the big, hairy, audacious goal. And I love that your brother Seth was with you the whole way. And yeah. And I also love your little Honda Civic Peppy. Because I think you were in Florida at the time or something, and your BHAG, you're like, I can't practice my BHAG. I can't prepare here. But, you know, what was that pivotal moment for you where you're like, no, I don't think this is what I need to do. I need to do something big.
Thank you for bringing that up, because it's an interesting story, and I'm glad you glossed over Westminster College, because it was a $100,000 party. I was Belushi from Animal House. I had a great time. And if I had to go back, well, I was reliving my high school years. You know, they were robbed of me. They were taken from me. And when I went to college, I thought, all right, well, let's start off molecular biology. That didn't work out because, you know, if you're taking immunology and organic chemistry and partying like Belushi, you have to open a book to pass those classes. So I wasn't really doing so well.
Yeah.
So long story short, let's say a woman of loose moral and ethical standards approached me at the bar numerous times, and I ended up taking her home, and she ended up passing out before we got to her apartment. And I carried her up three flights of stairs and was holding her in my arms, and I was kicking the door. You know, I was just banging on the door. I had no idea what was on the other side. It could have been some 6'8" giant dude who was going to thump me when I opened up the door because I was bringing his girlfriend home or something. But I was carrying her, and I was just kicking on this door. And another little female opened the door, and I just pushed this girl. I was like, does she belong to you? And she's like, again? So I took her inside. I dropped her off on one of those stable Papasan chairs. Remember they had that little base, like the half circle thing? You'd never put a drunk person in those chairs. So as I was leaving, I noticed on the coffee table that there were lines of coke, there were heroin needles, there were some burnt spoons, pills of whatever they were. And I had an epiphany on my way home, realizing, well, let me back up. I was asking myself who I was. And I don't think many people ask themselves that question. You know, how did I get to this point? Because as you said, everything, every seemingly mundane decision that we've all made in our past. Like if you're listening to this right now, you made a series of conscious and unconscious choices to be right here, right now, at this moment. You know, I won't get too deep into it. But for me, I realized that all those decisions I was making were unconscious because I was just kind of going on cruise control, like most of the world is now anyhow, right? So I took a step back and realized I was born and raised in Willard, Ohio, small farming community. Mom and dad raised this Midwest young man to have moral standards, ethics, and personal core values to make decisions. I wasn't doing that. So I stopped. I dropped out of school. I stopped working at the club. And that's when I decided I wanted to do something great with my life. And most people, they're comfortable where they are. I learned to be comfortable in the uncomfortable. So I wanted to push myself and see what the human body was capable of, and found that I wanted to literally use the highest platform in the world to give other people hope.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're living in Jacksonville, Florida, you realize that you want to climb Mount Everest. I mean, the highest point in Florida is the top of the Four Seasons Hotel in Miami. So I had to move to Colorado.
Yeah. So you and Seth packed up your little peppy and drove to Colorado. You moved. How I chuckled over this when you and I want to talk about preparation for Everest and physically, emotionally, spiritually, everything, Sean, I want you to tell our listeners. But I chuckled when I read about the part about the polar bear plunge, and you both did that. And the look on Seth's face when he came out of that. But you were doing crazy stuff, Sean, to prepare for this, like the rocks on your back. So tell our listeners, how did you prepare in all of those different ways for Everest?
Well, when you're training for something, or when you're attempting to do something no one in history has ever done before, you have to train and you have to do things that no one's ever done before. So I didn't really have any literature to go off of. I didn't have any coaches to use because no one had ever done this before. And I did know that a good day in the Himalayan mountains was probably better than a bad day in the Rocky Mountains. So I would head up. I moved to Estes Park, Colorado. My office was at the time of the library and a payphone bank. I mean, imagine calling up companies. Let's say you work for a large corporation. and you get a phone call. Hey, you know, I'm climbing Everest in 9 months, and I have one lung, and I've been through two terminal cancers, and I have pretty much no climbing experience. Like, hello, and anyone there? Like 9 times out of 10, the phone would hang up. They wouldn't take me seriously because they thought it was physiologically impossible to climb Everest with one lung. Like, you can't do it. So I kept pushing and kept pushing and pushing and pushing, and finally got some sponsors. But as far as the training goes, you know, I would go out in shorts in the winter time, and I would post hole, which is when you don't have snowshoes where you're walking on top of the snow. You have just your boots, and you step in the snow and your leg disappears. You know, so I would post hole in shorts, and I would go out in a short sleeve shirt. I would put snowballs in my hand. In the wintertime, I would drive around Estes Park with the windows down. I would do every tiny little thing to help me get adjusted and ready, because every tiny little thing would add up to a giant difference. Utilizing what's called the compound effect, you know, making small changes over time, you're going to have a giant result. And that was the whole concept and idea behind it. But also spiritually, mentally, having a deeper purpose for the mountain, for the summit. Because when I got to the top, what was I going to do? Celebrate, cry, then what? And because when I got to the top of Everest, which I'm sure we'll end up getting to, you know, there was a deeper purpose behind it. And once you establish that deeper purpose, not necessarily the why, but the deeper purpose, then you can withstand pretty much anything that gets in your way, because the meaning behind it means more to you and gives you more energy than everything else that might be draining you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about that. Let's talk, because you did not climb for yourself. You did not. You climbed with a purpose, and talk a little bit about that. Tell about the flag of hope.
The idea and the concept was, in which we did, we had a flag that was about, I don't know, 2 feet by 3 feet. And it had names of people touched by cancer. And we collected those names as a fundraiser, like $25 to put your name on there. Someone who was a survivor, someone who was going through treatment, or unfortunately, we all know people who have passed away from cancer. So anyone who has been touched by cancer in any way, I would print the names on the flag before leaving the States to head over to Nepal. But while I was there, my family was still collecting names, and I brought a Sharpie and I was handwriting names on the flag all the way up to the summit push. And a lot of people don't understand how long it really takes to climb Everest. I got to base camp April 8th. I summited May 16th. So you can do the math. That's a long time. And every time I went up and down the mountain, you know, we established 4 different camps over that time period. Every time I went up the mountain, in my chest pocket, close to my heart, was a reminder of why I was there. And that was the flag that had names of people touched by cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember True North was the North Pole, right? Wasn't that the trek to the North Pole? I think the documentary. And so we saw the flag, and I remember our daughter saying, wow, his handwriting is so good. The way that you had written on there, she goes, he's got great handwriting.
I did that because I knew people, because my handwriting, if I sent you something, if you look at what I wrote in your book, I'm sure you had to decipher the message I wrote in your book. But for the flag, I wanted to make sure it was printed out nice and neat and even, in case anyone ever sent me a message asking for a picture of that name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you did a really good job. You did a good job. And, you know, we could go into this. I've got so much more that I want to talk about. So we probably do need to take a quick break and then come right back and talk about more. But, you know, I'm sure that our listeners have kind of studied this, but there is danger in Everest. And I remember you talking about, Sean, you cannot summit too quickly. You can't, I mean, that's why it takes so long. You can't summit too quickly because, you know, of the thinning air, and there's terrible things that can happen if you do that. So, but how did you feel when you got to the top, Sean?
It's something that's inexplicable. It's something that you really can't put into words, because it's the most joyous elation you could possibly ever imagine. But then in the microseconds after that, you realize you had been focusing on getting to the top for all your training, all your vivid visualization. Every ounce and every cell in your body was focused on making it to the top, but you never thought about going back down. Climbing is a round trip sport that a lot of people don't think about. So when I got to the top, it was this the most amazing, if you could take every emotion you've ever had, bundle it up, and then explode it all at once, that's what it felt like. And then all of a sudden you're realizing, oh, wait a minute, I still have to get back down safely. That's where most of the injuries and deaths happen.
I did not realize that. Wow. Well, Sean, we do need to take a really quick break, and then we'll be right back with Sean Swarner on the Something Extra podcast.
In business, the tendency is to seek out partners who are bigger, faster, stronger. When it comes to IT, you should be looking for smarter, faster, better. That's just what you'll find with the talented technologists at Technology Partners. Our experts develop custom solutions to tackle your most complex challenges, all to simplify your processes in the smartest, most efficient way possible. The time to be swift and nimble starts now. Go to technologypartners.net/solutions and see what's possible.
Well, welcome back, everyone, to the Something Extra podcast with Sean Swarner. Oh, my goodness. I've absolutely loved this conversation. And you are. I agree with what the headlines say, Sean. You are such an inspirational person. And this has been so awesome so far. But after Everest, something drove you to pursue the Explorers Grand Slam. Tell us about that for our listeners who don't know. What is the Explorers Grand Slam, and what was the precipice for what? What was it that drove you to want to do that?
Well, I didn't name it because I know it sounds like a Denny's breakfast platter, but that's not what it is. It's not a Denny's breakfast platter. It is actually the highest mountain on every continent, which is the Seven Summits. Obviously, Everest is included as one of those, the highest mountain in Asia. The highest mountain on every continent, and then skiing to both the North and South Poles, literally covering the globe on this adventure. And I took that on because I believe less than 100 people have done it. I want to say I was number 50-something. First cancer survivor. And then if you toss in the world championship Ironman triathlon in Hawaii, I'm the only person. And to give you an idea of what the Ironman triathlon is, it's a 2.5 mile swim, 112 mile bike ride, and you finish with a marathon. So wrapping all those things up, I think it's proof to myself that I'm still alive, that I can handle any challenge that I put myself in. So I voluntarily put myself in these difficult situations because the regular, mundane, daily grind, I don't get stressed out. What's the point? Like, I don't have a polar bear chasing me like we did in True North when we were filming on Amazon.
Oh, that's so funny. Oh, my goodness. That is just crazy. Well, let me ask you this, Sean, because we've got listeners that are probably in all kinds of situations that are across the globe. You know, what advice would you give to people that may be listening that are crippled by fear right now?
Great question. And I'll answer that with a story. And because no one's ever had these two cancers before, Hodgkin's and Askin's sarcoma, I will never be cured. I will never be put in remission. I will never be okay. I'll never be healthy again. So not cancer free. I'll be NED, which is no evidence of disease, but no one knows what's going to happen. So I have to go back in once a year for a checkup. And imagine going into the hospital after having these two horrible bouts with cancer and every year reliving that when you're going in the hospital and you have the smells of saline, you have the smells of the sterile solutions, you have the smells of all these other things. And the sense that's closest linked to memory is the sense of smell. So even though I was in a coma for a year of my life, I'm having things come back in my memories. I was like, oh my God, I didn't even remember that. And that used to freak me out every single year. High anxiety. I would disappear from social media. I would disappear from my friends. I'd be like, hey, look, I just got my blood work taken. I'm out. I'm going to be a different person. Forget it. And then I'd get the results back. Everything would be okay. And then I would go back to normal. Until I realized I was allowing a six-letter word to control my emotions and feelings. I was relinquishing power of myself to some abstract concept that could potentially kill me. Yeah, it almost did. But why am I going to sit there and allow myself to give up that control of my emotions and my feelings to someone or something else? I mean, who's in control here? When you're talking about anxiety, when you're starting to worry about something, when fear starts to creep in, the more and more you try to fight against it, the harder it becomes, the more real, the more anxious you become, the more scared you become. It's like trying harder to beat anxiety is like trying harder to fall asleep. It doesn't work. So when you realize that you are in control and you allow this fear to come in and be like, hey, look, no one's ever died of a panic attack before, which I've had a couple, you know, and they're debilitating. No one's ever died of a panic attack before. It's just an emotional feeling that comes in because your brain and your signals get crossed, get mixed up, whatever. Accept it. Acknowledge it. It's there. Okay. It's going to pass. And one of the biggest things that I did to help release the power that cancer had on me, so even saying it now, cancer, who cares? It rolls right off the tongue. Realizing that it's not a trigger, it's how I reacted to that trigger. So what I did was I went into the bathroom and I looked in the mirror. And I said that word 40 or 50 times, looking at myself in the mirror. And I said, cancer, 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 cancer. You know, about 30 times into it, I'm like, what the hell am I doing? This is stupid. Like, I'm allowing something else to control my feelings and my emotions. Now, I'm not saying that being anxious and scared is stupid. What I'm saying is allowing something else to control your emotions is. So you have to learn to bring those back. So whatever is scaring you, whatever anxiety-ridden thing you have, write it down on a piece of paper, go into the bathroom, stare yourself in the mirror and say that word or words, you know, multiple times, 50 times over, over and over and over again, because the more it comes out, the less control it has over you on the inside.
Mm-hmm. That's so good. That is so good. What about loss of hope for people that are plagued right now with loss of hope?
You know, I think I said it before. If you have ever had a goal, if you've ever had someone who cared about you, you have something to fight for. You have something to push forward, a reason to push forward. It could be a child. It could be your significant other. It could be your mom, your dad, whoever. It could be a good friend. It doesn't matter. Find someone or something outside of you to empower you. Like, hey, look, if I'm losing hope, maybe I can take a couple steps and do it for someone else. Then you can start going and taking that back and empowering yourself, because then you take that quick look in the mirror. Why am I really doing this? You know, I'm not doing this for Lisa. I'm not doing this for people touched by cancer. I'm really doing it for me. And by doing it for me, by taking care of myself first, then I can give my all to someone else.
Yeah, that's really good. That's good, Sean. Do you have a personal mantra? Like, when you kind of start like getting your mindset wonky, do you have a mantra that, or, you know, a go-to? Do you, you know, I know you're big on visualization. I don't know if you can talk about that at all. But is there like a personal go-to that you have when you, 'cause I'm sure you don't do this perfectly all the time. your mindset's not always perfect, I'm sure, Sean.
No, if I said I was happy and joyous and full of energy every single day, every single hour, I'd be lying to you, and I'd probably be on some prescription drugs to make me feel that way. But vivid visualization is huge. And using it for Everest, I picked in all the mountains, everything I've ever done. In fact, a good example would be Everest. Every night I went to bed, I pictured myself taking the last three or four steps to the summit. I would, in my mind's eye, hear the sound of the snow crunching under my feet, sounding like styrofoam, crinkling. I would smell the ozone. I would feel the sun's radiation on my face. But the biggest disconnect that people have is they stop there, as opposed to understanding how you feel when you reach the goal. So in my mind's eye, connecting my mind and my body with the emotions, that became real when I pictured and felt how it was at the top of Everest. You know, I did something similar running the New York City Marathon. I didn't train for the New York City Marathon at all. But in my mind, I pictured myself every night for a few months leading up to it, crossing the finish line. How did I feel crossing the finish line? Granted, my whole leg, my quad, my hamstring seized up and I hobbled across the finish line, but I finished. And when I actually crossed the finish line, this wave of emotion came over me. You know, I started crying because I was emotionally exhausted, mentally exhausted, spiritually exhausted. But that vivid visualization really taps into your mind. And there's been so many scientific studies on how it really, really works. But as far as a mantra, when I was on Everest and when I'm running, I tell myself, and you can pick something too, with my right leg or my left leg. So with one leg, I tell myself, the higher I go, the next step I tell myself, the stronger I get. The higher I go, the stronger I get. The higher I go, the stronger I get. The higher I go, the stronger I get. Over and over and over again, because your mind is like a glass of water. Dirty water represents negative thoughts. Clean water represents positive thoughts. And if you have a glass of dirty water, turn on the faucet and constantly flush it through with positive thoughts, you're going to have a glass of clean water. Mind is the same thing. You know, there's that saying, you are what you eat, but in reality, you are what you consume. So pay attention to what you are allowing into your mind, because it's just like a computer and it's being programmed by external sources or yourself. So it's your choice how you want to program your brain.
Oh, that is so good. That is so good. Well, let me ask you this. You know, how can you talk a little bit? Because I'm thinking about leaders out there and how leaders can inspire their people to have this unstoppable mindset. And maybe you have some ideas on that. But Sean, how does, and I don't like the word failure. I always say it's like an opportunity to grow, but how can like failure and that sort of thing really, what role does that play in having an unstoppable mindset in your mind?
Well, I think failure is only when you don't try. You know, my goal on Everest was to make it to the top, but it was a success being on the mountain. You know, and I truly enjoy the journey. And one thing that I've learned over the years is when you reach the summit of whatever peak you're climbing, there are always going to be other mountains to climb. There always will be other peaks to reach. When you cross that finish line, there will always be other races to run. So you have to really enjoy the process. Now, I'm not saying every moment is going to be easy. Running a marathon is not easy. Climbing Mount Everest is not easy. But find something in your day-to-day that you really enjoy. Embrace that, hold on to it, and appreciate it. You know, and also, every morning I wake up, a lot of people can change this too. They grab their phone. So, you know, their phone's their alarm clock. You know, what happens? They grab their phone. They start scrolling through social media. And what you're doing now is you're comparing yourself potentially at your worst to someone else's best, because that's all you see on social media, right? Or you're watching the news. You start your day on a negative note. Start your day with an affirmation that means something to you. You know, I start my day by saying yesterday's gone. There's nothing I can do about it. Tomorrow may never come. No matter what happens today, today is the best day ever. And it's my choice to make it that way. But as far as leaders go, you can inspire people, you can motivate people, but that will never last. You have to empower people. And you have to do that based on what they value, not what you value for them. You know, we're all individual people. And going back to Kilimanjaro, the average success rate on the mountain is 48%. Less than half the people who go up that mountain don't make it, right? My groups are at 99% success rate. I've been up the mountain 25 times. And I think one of the reasons is because when it's dangerous, I'm up front saying, hey, put your foot here, put your hand here, step there, do this, do that. When it's dangerous. When it's not dangerous and it's kind of easy moving, I lead from behind. So many people think that they need to be out front blazing the trail and be this bold leader and tell people what to do. That doesn't work. Because there's a difference between a leader, between being a good leader and just being a boss. You know, you can tell people what to do all day long, but leaders are respected. And I think leading from behind is the key.
I am so glad that you brought that up, because I remember the first time you and I talked, that's what you said. You said, I lead from behind. But I love what you just said. Sometimes you lead from the front because you want to show them and model for them the landmine. Step here, you know, here is, but, oh, wow, those are such great leadership lessons. Well, let's talk about this, and then we're going to talk about something extra. What are you preparing for, Sean? When you told me, I'm like, what is that? Tell me more. What are you preparing for right now?
So I'm preparing for something that, I feel like Forrest Gump, because I'm constantly running and running and running and running. I'm preparing for running 7 marathons in 7 days on all 7 continents. So in a week, I'm going to run 180 some miles in 160 some hours.
It's crazy. I had said to you when you told me that, I'm like, Sean, is that even possible? But it is a thing, and that's coming up in December, right?
It is. You know, it's funny. I don't know if you want to include this or not, but I had a call with my mom not too long ago. And as you can tell, I'm pretty close with my mom and my whole family. But I was talking to my mom, and I told her, Mom, I got sponsorship for this. You know, it's covered. We're looking for flight sponsorship, but the travel, a lot of different things are covered. And she doesn't want me to do this. So if she watches this, I'm sorry, Mom, it's going to happen. But I was like, Mom, I got sponsorship. And she's like, from who, a funeral home? I was like, Mom, are you kidding me? Like, come on.
That is hilarious. Oh, my goodness. Always a mama watching out for her kiddos. But I know she's proud of you too, Sean. But that's probably scary for her. Oh, my goodness. Well, one thing that you say, Sean, and I just see it even in our conversation today, you said there's nothing stronger than the human spirit. And I love that quote by you.
Absolutely. And developing that human spirit comes from understanding what your personal core values are. You know, so many people, so many leaders, so many entrepreneurs, so many CEOs, presidents, whatever it might be, they have values for the corporation. They have values and a motto for the business. How many people have spent time, not from like their day, their weeks, their months, their hours, from their lives to actually sit down and figure out or write down what their personal core values are? Because if you don't know what those are, how are you going to live a happy, fulfilling, conscientious life?
Yeah, I say that all the time, because we do. We have strategic plans for our businesses, but do you have a plan for your life? And of course, we have to hold our plans loosely, right, Sean? I mean, you could never have anticipated getting cancer, but those core values, I mean, are those true north, if you will, are the things that you're not going to compromise. And knowing that, I think, is very, very important as an individual. Well, goodness, I could just continue to talk to you for hours and hours and hours, but and I know you have a commercial that that you have to film. So what is the something extra, Sean, do you believe every leader needs?
You know, I think we've hit on that numerous times throughout this conversation. And I think the something extra that every leader needs is to get out of their own way. I think they need to learn to lead from behind, get your personal core values order. You can, because you can be an inspiration to so many people, but if you're not empowering them, what's the point? You can bark orders all day long, but if you don't have that respect because you're not authentic and you're not a genuine person and you don't want the best for someone else, what's the point? You have to eliminate the ego. The ego just gets in the way.
Mm. Could not agree more. You're there to serve. You're there to serve your people. Well, Sean, this has been so good. I loved this interview with you. I cannot wait for our listeners to learn from you. I can't wait for them to go get the book, listeners, Being Unstoppable, Conquering Your Everest. Connect with Sean. He is the most approachable, authentic person. You will just, you'll love learning from him. Go watch True North. It's on, you can watch it on YouTube, right, Sean? So we'll put all of that in the show notes and get to know Sean even more. Well, thank you so much, Sean, for making the time to be on the show today. This was a delight.
Oh, absolutely. I really appreciate the opportunity to share my story, but thank you for helping so many other people who are listening, and thank you for doing what you're doing. It's a blessing.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.